From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Senate has ground to a halt just days after President Joe Biden was inaugurated. Because the Democratic Party controls only 50 seats, and by virtue of Vice President Kamala Harris is technically considered the majority party, lawmakers are fighting over the rules by which the body can legislate. Republicans want to preserve the use of the Senate filibuster. Meanwhile, independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who caucuses with the Democrats and who has a new role as the powerful Senate Budget Committee chair, wants to use a process of reconciliation to pass major legislation without GOP support. To top it all off, the second impeachment of Donald Trump looms large. My guest is John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine and host of the podcast Next Left. He's a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, an associate editor of the Capital Times, and also the author of numerous books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. And he's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, John.
Sonali, it's great to be with you.
So this idea that the Democrats shouldn't just assume the position of majority party is based on the fact that technically the Senate is split 50-50 and they're only the majority party because they also happen to control the presidency and the vice presidency. How many times in U.S. history has it happened that there's been this perfect 50-50 split? And is there a precedent for how the Senate functions under such conditions?
Well, it has happened before. It's relatively uncommon, but you had in the 1950s a pattern of splits that were so narrow that it would sometimes be affected by a special election or by a particular Senator Wayne Morse from Oregon literally moving his desk across the aisle to go from one party to the other. And so we've seen this in the past. In the contemporary era, the most recent example of it was in 2001, right after the presidential election, the very contested presidential election of 2000, where you had a very narrowly divided Senate, and they had to come up with a deal, an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats, which allowed for business to be done. And so there is precedent for this, but I'd really emphasize, Sonali, that we live in a very, very different era than certainly the 1950s when Eisenhower was president, or even the early 2000s. This moment now is a time of hyper-politicization, frankly, on the part of both parties, but especially on the part of the Republican Party. And I think Mitch McConnell very well recognizes that anything he gives up at this point, he is unlikely to ever get back. And so you're seeing a real kind of bitter struggle now over the filibuster and, frankly, a lot of other rules.
Let's talk about the filibuster. Depending upon who you talk to, it's either an incredible tool or a complete threat to democracy. What is the Senate filibuster? Just to get that sort of basic civics, lesson on this. And where do you fall on the spectrum of, seeing it as either a tool or an impediment?
Sure. That's a great question. And it's exactly the way to go at it, because I think so many people are unfamiliar with the history of the filibuster and, frankly, its functioning. The filibuster isn't outlined in the Constitution. The founders didn't establish it. As we understand it today, it did not exist through much of the history of the Senate. There was an acceptance historically that if you had a major debate, a major fight in the Senate, and one senator got the floor, that senator could speak, as long as he could stand, against perhaps a measure that he opposed, perhaps a war declaration or some other issue. And so there's history on the filibuster, but what we have today is nothing like what was portrayed in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where Jimmy Stewart stood and kind of rallied the country with an agonizingly long speech. What we have today is a mechanized filibuster. It is so routinized that you don't even have to stand on the floor anymore. You don't give the speech. What you do is you just call a phone number, a hotline, and you say, "Oh, I oppose this bill," and then you lock in effectively a filibuster. And it gives immense power to an individual senator who is part, could be even part of a minority party, but can be roughly assured that at least 40 members won't go against him. And so what that means is that you can grind Senate action to a halt, not for one day or as long as somebody can speak and give a filibuster in the traditional sense, but frankly, for months, even years on particular issues. And this is a huge, huge impediment to governing and to making it function. Now, I actually have respect for the idea of the ability of an individual senator to stand and do a speaking filibuster, to literally get up and say for 12 hours or 24 hours, this is wrong. In a sense, Bernie Sanders tried that about the better part of 15 years ago when he gave what's referred to as the speech.
Right,
and
I
it was
remember
a very
that.
Long, well, of course, yeah, yeah. And it was a long objection to compromises on tax policy and economic policy that I think captured the imagination of the country. And you can go back to Robert M. La Follette's filibusters or attempted filibusters against World War I. Those are more positive versions. You see the ugly side of it with Strom Thurmond's filibusters against civil rights. And so I understand all of that as a part of the Senate. And I can accept that has a place, right? It's an opportunity to highlight an issue. But what we've got now doesn't function. It ought to be changed. They ought to do away with the filibuster as it currently exists and move toward a system where, aside from the debate, the honest debate, where maybe somebody would give a long speech, once you get beyond that, you ought to be able to have a vote on any measure or nomination that has been proposed. So if it were left to me, I would do away with the filibuster and move effectively to majority rule.
And so essentially, if you have that in place, if you have the power to have a filibuster in place, it would mean that anything that the Democrats want to get through the Senate would require what's called a filibuster-proof majority, a supermajority, right? 67 votes.
Just 60.
60, I see. That's right. A filibuster, that's right. It's different
a little
from
bit
the...
less.
Different from the what's needed to, say, convict a president for impeachment, which we'll get to in just a moment. So they would need 60 votes, effectively meaning that unless they can convince at least 10 Republicans to join all Democrats, or I suppose at least 9 Republicans with Kamala Harris's vote to join all Democrats, they wouldn't be able to get anything passed, which, of course, deeply imperils Biden's agenda. But in order to get a filibuster out of the way, how many votes do Democrats need?
Oh, that's the interesting thing. They don't need a majority or they don't need this supermajority. When you are setting the rules of the Senate at the start of each session of the Senate, if a majority agree to a set of rules that doesn't include the filibuster as it has currently developed, it's done.
So then you have to have all Democrats in line, and we're already seeing the conservative Democrats like John Tester of Montana saying they wouldn't join. He wouldn't join his fellow Democrats in doing away with the filibuster in this moment that the Senate is fighting, that Democrats are fighting to keep control of the Senate. Is Tester the only one? What about Manchin of West Virginia?
Yeah, Tester is far from the only one. And frankly, I would even suggest to you that Tester, while I happen to disagree with him on this issue, is not a particularly conservative Democrat. On a lot of issues, he's actually been a relatively good player. There are members who are more conservative than him, and frankly, more corporate than he is. And what you'll see is that there are 5 or 6 senators at this point who I would suggest fall into the likely anti-filibuster camp. Now, it might not be quite that many, but you've got certainly enough to prevent a move to get rid of the filibuster. And that does, John Tester has spoken up on it. So too has Joe Manchin, at least in some conversations. You're going to find a number of other, I think it's fair to say, more centrist and corporate members who are resistant to it. And in some cases, they come from small states or from states where they want that leverage, and that's a part of the debate. But in other cases, frankly, it's about them themselves. Because to give you an example, in the case of Joe Manchin from West Virginia, As a very centrist, even center-right Democrat, if he has the filibuster option in play, if that's in play for him, he's got a lot of power, right? I mean, he's essentially the person who on almost any issue can break the Democratic majority. Now, the Republicans can still play their games and obviously do what they do. But there's just a lot of power that goes to someone who wants to be sort of a rogue senator, a lone wolf. And so you got a problem here. It's a real challenge.
How is it that the Republicans managed to get their party members in line so effectively when they have controlled the party? Because they haven't, in recent years, controlled it by a very large majority. Their majority, too, has been slim, not as slim as 50-50. It seems as though, is it just former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's skill in getting his party members to fall in line?
A lot of it does have to do with McConnell's skill, and that has to be understood. He is a master of the Senate. There's simply no question. People need to understand this about Mitch McConnell. He came to Washington as a congressional aide during John Kennedy's presidency. He has been on or around Capitol Hill for almost 60 years. And during that time, he's moved from being a kind of a moderate Republican to a very right-wing Republican, but he's always been one thing, and that's very corporate, very business friendly. And this is the big deal, because in addition to his mastery of the Senate, Mitch McConnell controls the money that Republican senators need to get elected. And obviously there's some senators who are in very safe states, that's less of a factor, but those tend to be senators who are aligned with McConnell anyway. In senators from battleground states, or for senators from battleground states, McConnell is a very, very big force in deciding whether they get to remain as senators. And so as a result, he has a lot of power there. He's also very strategic about this. He does choose his battles. He doesn't, fight on every issue. He finds the issues where he's going to be able to deliver for his president, his campaign donors, his party. And he also does something else, which is really interesting. He allows individual senators to break off if it's possible. And so he'll allow a Susan Collins to break off on a Supreme Court nomination or someone else. But when it gets to the critical vote, when it gets to, kind of up or down, because McConnell has so much control over the money and because he has shown that occasional flexibility, he tends to be able to rally his caucus very effectively. It's not to say that Schumer couldn't do something similar, but for a variety of reasons, I think, and this is perhaps the deepest reality of it, I think a lot of Republicans recognize that they're always going to be on the margins, that their political appeal is very, very limited when you get to the heart of the matter. They are arguing for tax breaks for the wealthiest people in the country, tax breaks for multinational corporations, social policies that are not particularly popular. And so how do they maintain their power? I think there's a lot of Republicans, whether they're called right-wingers or conservatives or even moderate conservatives, whatever you want to call them, who recognize that if their unity slips, they are unlikely to maintain their power, and not only just to hold their seats, but also to maintain any kind of option for getting control of the Senate. That all comes into play.
This might be a good time to remember that this new Senate has Senate Democrats representing together 20 million more Americans, roughly. It's more like 41 million more Americans than the 50 Republican senators. So, if you think about the kind of mandate that the Democratic Party has, even if they just control 50 seats in the Senate plus the vice presidency, if you want to argue morality, the Democrats do represent many more Americans.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And this varies from cycle to cycle, sure. Right? And it can be a smaller number. I think on the Amy Coney Barrett vote, there was something like a disproportionality of about 14 million voters, on one side versus the other on the Democratic side, even though the Democrats were the minority there. And the thing to understand is this, that the Senate is effectively a House of Lords. if you were thinking in the British context. Now, the Brits don't elect their House of Lords, it's appointed, but still it's this concept that you have a very anti-democratic, anti-small-d democratic upper chamber, and then you have in the British context, you have a parliament that is elected. And in the United States, we have a House of Representatives, which is a mess because of gerrymandering and a host of other things, but it is still relatively representative. The Senate is not. It's an absurd institution in so many regards. To give you one example, you can get elected to a U.S. Senate seat from, for instance, Wyoming, with around 150,000 votes. To get elected from California in a competitive election, you need, you know, at least 5 million or more, maybe 6 million votes, and you could run up even more than that. And so that senator from Wyoming, that one senator from Wyoming, can cancel out the vote of that senator from California. Mm-hmm. And this gives an incredibly disproportional power to small states.
So let's talk about what independent Senator of Vermont, Bernie Sanders, is saying that he would like to do. First of all, it is quite positive to see him leading the Senate Budget Committee. I know there was some disappointment on the left that he wasn't offered the position of Labor Secretary, but many have pointed out that his position as a senator gives him far more power, especially now that he would be chair of the Budget Committee. He has said he wants to use the same process to pass things like a COVID relief bill that Republicans used to pass their destructive tax reform bill that Trump signed into law. What is this budget reconciliation process he's talking about, and how would he go about using it?
Sure. Budget reconciliation is also something that wasn't outlined in the Constitution or anything like that. It's a relatively recent development. There was a budget reconciliation bill of 1974, I believe. And so for about the last 50 some years, we've had a process in the Senate that allows, and this is also true in the House, but in the Senate, that allows for certain budget bills, certain bills that are identified as involving financial emergencies, just keeping the government running and things of that nature. For practical purposes, they can be drawn up in a Senate committee, moved to the Senate floor with a requirement that they only need a majority vote rather than a supermajority. And so they effectively cancel out the filibuster. And you still have to get the majority, right? So there's still that issue. But in the case of what Sanders is talking about, for instance, if he can get, we could use the $1.9 trillion stimulus or coronavirus relief bill that Biden's proposed, but let's make it even simpler than that. We had a debate recently about $2,000 relief checks for Americans who are in a difficult situation. We knew that the Democrats were together on that issue, or overwhelmingly together. And he actually had 5, 6, maybe 7 Republicans who said they were sympathetic to it as well. So there you've got clearly a majority, but you might not have a filibuster-proof majority. If Sanders were to come up with a strategy for budget reconciliation, it's a little bit harder on this one, but let's say he did that and was able to move it out of his committee to the floor, you could have a vote in a day and get those $2,000 checks out. So that's it really is, this is a tool that can be used to speed up the process of the Senate.
Is it only apply for certain kinds of bills, though?
Yeah, it's financial stuff. It's budget stuff. Now, admittedly, you could say almost everything touches the budget,
right?
But there are constraints on this. And one of the challenges is you got to get the whole budget. You know, for instance, you have to get the whole budget committee together on it in the initial stage. And there's a lot of subtleties to it. But at the end of the day, what Sanders is talking about is something more than just the Budget Reconciliation Act or things of that nature. What he's really talking about is an aggressive stance, essentially saying, we know there are things that the American people need, and we are going to use all of the tools that we have, whatever rules are available, whatever structures are available, to move quickly and effectively on those issues. That is something that Democrats in the past have been cautious about doing. And so it's a big deal that Sanders is scoping this out. It essentially kind of breaks the quote unquote gentleman's agreement in the Senate and puts the Democrats in a position where they might act as a caucus that's at least as aggressive, maybe more aggressive than the Republicans.
Meanwhile, we found out on Monday that Sanders's colleague Patrick Leahy of Vermont has actually been chosen to preside over a Senate impeachment trial rather than Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. So on Monday, you have the House having presented the article of impeachment against Donald Trump for incitement of insurrection to the Senate. There was a moment a couple of weeks ago when Republican senators appeared ready to convict Trump, and now they seem to be deciding that it's not worth it. Although Mitch McConnell apparently still privately believes it's important for the impeachment trial to be a good way to rid his party of Trump, who's been problematic for him. And then there's also this whole question about, well, this will hamper Biden's agenda being consumed by the impeachment, and others have said, no, you can actually do both at the same time. What do you think is going to happen on impeachment? It seems as though, you know, if Tim Cotton and Ted Cruz have their way, Trump will once more be acquitted by the Senate if they go through with this.
It's a very real possibility that Trump could be acquitted, but it doesn't in any way detract from the necessity of putting this forward. If the argument was that, you know, someone who committed murder might be acquitted, and you say, well, then we just won't try him. Or someone who committed fraud might be acquitted. Well, we just won't try him.
And what's amazing is that the FBI is saying that even now, there are literally threats against lawmakers by pro-Trump people seen on the dark corners of the internet, people promising violence against legislators as the impeachment trial is going forward, which really suggests that if the Capitol riot isn't treated as the coup attempt that it was and punished, it will simply be a trial run for the next one.
Well, you run that danger. And, you know, look, I think, as you know, Sonali, I've been an advocate for a much more aggressive stance as regards impeachment for a very long time. I wrote a book about it years ago, and I continue to hold to this view that if you don't impeach, try, and convict, when you have clear evidence of wrongdoing, then you essentially lock in an approach to the presidency, an imperial presidency, that will extend and even become worse in future presidencies. And I don't think there's any question that that's the case. A failure to see through the Nixon impeachment laid groundwork that I think you saw play out in the Reagan presidency. A failure to impeach, try, and convict Reagan for Iran-Contra, I think, you know, again, opened up more territory. A failure to hold Bush and Cheney to account for their actions as regards the Iraq War opens up more territory. And at the end of the day, you end up in a situation where presidents feel they can operate, you know, essentially without limits. You saw that come to a head with Trump. And you know, as has been said by people wiser than I, if you cannot impeach, try, and remove a president of the United States for inciting insurrection against the United States, literally sending people to the Capitol to try and overturn an election result, then, I mean, you know, we might as well shred the Constitution and say impeachment doesn't exist anymore. So this is a critical test. And I get impatient with people who say, well, this might slow down the Biden agenda. You know, everything we've talked about for the last 10 minutes or so here suggests that the Republicans are going to do everything. You know, they can do stuff to slow down that agenda wherever they can anyway. So holding Donald Trump to account doesn't slow down any agenda. It doesn't undermine unity. It doesn't do any harm. It does a good. And that good is to suggest that in this country, if a president takes actions that are clearly threats to the Constitution, to the health, to the safety, to the future of the Republic, you don't have a right to impeach that president. You have a responsibility. I hope this does advance, you know, with full energy.
For the Republicans to demand unity when they can't even be unified about the fact that Joe Biden fairly and squarely won the 2020 election is pretty rich. I want to wrap up our conversation, John, with discussing the Nation magazine's special issue devoted to the first 100 days of Joe Biden's presidency and what it's going to take to undo the damage of the four Trump years and, broadly speaking, of the Republican Party. I mean, we should should be heartened by the fact that at least Americans, if not Republican lawmakers, a majority of Americans rejected the Trump agenda. So now what? How to go forward? What is your special issue at the Nation magazine outline?
It's a good issue, and it's one that excites me. I just contributed one part of it, but a number of writers, many from the Nation, and many people who are activists in a host of different areas have written for it. And essentially, the argument is that this has to be a presidency sufficient to the challenges that Joe Biden faces, and Kamala Harris as well. And what is that challenge? Well, we have a pandemic that continues to rage. We have the challenge of providing vaccinations in an equitable and fair way, not just to everyone in the United States, but to people around the world. We have an economic crisis that extends from that pandemic that has seen mass unemployment at levels comparable to the Great Depression, at least at some periods over the last year. And we've seen economic and business downturns that are extremely severe. We have a cry for racial justice that, you know, I think you can trace back 400 years, but has been amplified in the last year, but has not been answered. We have a climate crisis where the clock is ticking so fast that we can literally measure month by month the closing of the window by which we might address it. And we have a set of budget priorities in this country that continue to fund a military-industrial complex while telling hungry children there's just not enough money to feed them. And so there's so much that Joe Biden has to do. It's very, very hard to simply undo the damage that Trump did. It's even harder to deal with the issues that existed even before Trump came. The answer that this issue comes back to again and again is twofold. Number one, something we were just talking about, there has to be accountability. President Biden can't get in the way of efforts to hold Donald Trump and others to account for their high crimes and misdemeanors, for their law breaking, and for the tremendous damage that they did to this country, particularly during the coronavirus pandemic, with their neglect and willful efforts to undermine a responsible approach to the pandemic itself. But coupled with accountability, there has to be an agenda, a vision for the future that separates from Trump and says, you know, yeah, we want to undo the damage he did, but we want to do so many things that have been left undone for a long time. Biden's actually doing some good things in this regard with his executive orders. There's an argument in this issue and beyond it for a very aggressive use of executive orders. It gets you into a lot of areas that are vital. But as regards to finance issues, the money issues, Congress still controls the purse strings. And so at the end of the day, there really is an argument for Biden and the Democrats to develop a much more coherent vision for governing. This is not something new. In a sense, they have to go back to the Franklin Roosevelt model, where Roosevelt, who did have bigger majorities, there's no question of that, but Roosevelt always made the case for governing in a bold way. He didn't always get it right. Roosevelt was flawed and made plenty of errors. But at the end of the day, there was this effort to err on the side of boldness. And what you saw was the American people loved that. They loved the notion of a federal government that was actually trying to solve fundamental problems. And so if there's one theme that we come back to again and again, it is that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have to identify this presidency as a presidency that is about solving fundamental problems of economic and social and racial injustice, climate crisis, and frankly, the need for a very different U.S. foreign policy.
And in fact, Bernie Sanders has been already warning that if Democrats don't take such an aggressive posture, they will lose catastrophically in 2022 at the next midterm races, because that is what happened last time during Obama's first term. Well, John, thank you as always for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of their podcast Next Left, and a prolific author. His latest book is called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist and Anti-Racist Politics. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.